The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
After he conducted the first sit-in demonstration in San Francisco in 1961, Willie Brown fell in love with politics and never looked back. During his time as de mayor, he refurbished and rebuilt the nation's busiest transit system, pioneered the use of bond measures to build affordable housing, and created a model juvenile justice system. The former two-term mayor was also the longest-serving speaker of the California Assembly. In his conversation tonight with veteran journalist and author Bill Boyarsky, Willie Brown may talk about the following: his assessment of current politicians, you can fill in the blanks, his candid rules for surviving and manipulating big money and big media in politics, his Uncle Itzy, his campaign advice for the Dems in 08, or his awe-inspiring story of how an African-American boy born in segregated Texas, the son of a cook, rose to be at the center of California and national politics for an astonishing four decades. In conversation with Willie Brown tonight is Bill Boyarsky, whose long and distinguished career as a writer and journalist includes 31 years with the Los Angeles Times and prior to that, 10 years with the Associated Press. As an award-winning columnist and city editor for the Times, he covered the inner workings of government and politics at the national, state, and local levels, and also served as general assignment reporter. He participated in team coverage of the paper that won three Pulitzers, and he is a recipient of the California First Amendment Coalition Journalist Award. He's the author of four books, most recently a biography of California State Assembly Speaker and State Treasurer Jesse Unruh, Willie Brown's predecessor. So it's very relevant to tonight. Please join me now in welcoming Willie Brown and Bill Boyarsky to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Welcome to our library, Mayor Brown. We're very proud of it. My wife, Nancy, says it's one of the most beautiful buildings in the world. I don't know if that's true, but it is a beautiful building, and we're pleased to have you here. I thought your book was terrific. I really enjoyed it, and I urge you all to buy a copy of it. I met you in 1962 when you were a first-term assemblyman. Coming up from San Francisco, 1963 it would be, because you were elected in 1962.
No, I lost in 62.
You lost, so I met you in...
64.
64, and you came up, and I was a young reporter for the Associated Press, and he and his colleague from San Francisco and his friend John Burton came up together, and as a young reporter, the really big shots didn't waste a lot of time on a young reporter for the Associated Press, and so we talked to the young legislators, and you were, that's where we, where I got to meet you, and you were very, very helpful. Louise went over your career highlights, so let's get right on to our little talk. Why did you write this book?
For money.
That's good. Well, did you feel that the press hadn't caught the real Willie Brown?
No, I don't care what the press does.
What about Jim Richardson?
Finish.
He wrote this whole long biography.
Let me finish. The press, in the time that I served in various places, both Sacramento and San Francisco, they wrote about me, they covered me. As a matter of fact, one or two of them actually made it a cottage industry to cover me. They were, I always said that they really should have been not on the page where facts were reported, but where fiction was reported, because more often than not, they made stuff up in order.
I'm shocked.
Well, I'm sure you are, But the beauty of their creativity was that the public had come to know me so well that they could conceive of how I may very well have done what they said. So there's a lot of credibility there. And sometimes I would even take credit for it, although I didn't do it. And as the book evidenced on more than one occasion. And so when you say, did I write this in order to put it the perspective correctly and do something about challenging what the president... No, I did not. I don't want to challenge the press. You had 41 plus years of doing the business and most of the reporters in the same category. Except I didn't know, frankly, that you were talking to us because nobody else would talk to you.
You thought I liked
you. I thought we were special. Now you tell me. Wait till I tell Burton.
I know.
You'd found two geniuses and you were covering.
It's an awful...
Associated Press? I mean, that was big stuff.
I know. Newcomers. It's an awful way to earn a living and I'm ashamed of it. In your book, though, the chapters end with lessons, some of them, with lessons for future politicians. Did you want to do that?
That's what the book was. That's why the book was done the way that it was done.
Yeah.
When people start approaching me as early as, 1990 and 1991, mm-hmm. about doing a book, some of your colleagues on the reporting side thought that by the time I'd reached the 90s, that there was really a story. We had not envisioned the mayor's operation. So there were people who worked for the Chronicle, the Steve, the good one, mm-hmm. who eventually went to work for the Bee, wanted to do. And he put together a treatment, I think they called it in those days, and tried it with Harper Collins and a couple of other people. And they were not terribly interested. At least they didn't evidence any great interest. And then Art Torres came along, and some guy had $100,000 he wanted to, as an advance against royalties, to do a book, and I didn't, I really didn't want to do it. Besides that, the statute had not run mm-hmm. on some of the things that would have to be covered, so I wouldn't do the book. But I did do an oral history for the University of California, for the Bancroft Library, and so that what I had participated in public policy making in California would be available for students to really use as reference points, not knowing at the time that that's a good jump-off point if you ultimately are going to do a book. Mm-hmm. Some of the facts are there, and they were fresher than when you may want to do the book. And then in 2004, when I left the mayor's office, Hillary Clinton's lawyer and agent, Bob Barnett, chatted with me. He saw me during the time that the Washington Speakers Bureau recruited me to go as part of their portfolio of speakers around the country. And we talked several times, and finally he took me in to the people at Simon & Schuster, which really was, quite prestigious. And they convinced me, with a lot of dead presidents, mm-hmm. that was a good idea to do a book. Uh-huh. And I was in need of dead presidents. And so I accepted and started to do this book. Well, I learned what you already know, since you've done four, that you don't exactly have a book in you when you start out. You really don't. You don't sit down and you're not John Grisham. Right. Danielle Steele, Tom Clancy, Robert Ludlum. You're none of the people who write books. You really are. And particularly if you got to write about yourself, there is no way you want to do that, truthfully. It's a challenge. You start thinking, well, no, I can't write about her. So it really did become a problem. Really great proportions. But I eventually got over it, particularly when they started making noises about non-contract compliance, deadlines, and return of money. I became highly motivated.
Well, it worked.
And in my motivation, I as a result of my motivation, I went back and started looking at other people who had done their memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
Man, are they dull.
Right.
You're talking about... I said, no, I can't do that. Nobody cares, ultimately, you know, about all those little things, about your dad, as Bill Clinton did, driving down the highway and apparently was loaded or something, ran off the road and killed himself. You know, who cares, you know, ultimately? Well, how does that have any impact on your life? I'd rather for you to start with what you did and mm-hmm. how you would have done it differently if you'd had this anchor tenant. Well, I decided, no, this book is going to be an instructional handbook for wannabes, and it must also be capable of enjoyment, and it must be capable of being read on a chapter-by-chapter basis, and each chapter had to be a complete story
yeah.
unto itself, and it's got to be read, and it's got to be written in such a way that you can do chapters in the bathroom every time you go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Just lead a book in the bathroom.
Right.
Do the chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's sure. a bathroom chapter book.
Oh, that's a good idea. Well, and so, and in there are lessons. We'll get into this later in the thing about some of the lessons that you draw. But I want to ask you now, I was particularly interested because it's so timely about Chapter 6, Black Politics and Racism Today. And with Barack Obama running such a strong race for the nomination, I'd like to talk about that. And here's something you wrote at the end of the chapter that I'd like to read. The lessons for African Americans, I guess, is that you have to fight every day to maintain the progress you've made. And if you're a black politician, you'd better expect to face the charge every day, the charge every day of being above yourself, to prove yourself. God forbid you should appoint blacks or friends to high office. Loyalty is something allowed only to the country club set. Could you expand on that? And there was a slight tone of anger in that, I thought. Could you go on a bit about that?
I would hope not.
I didn't know what to ask you. I was going to say there was a slight tone of anger, a slight tone of bitterness. It was a slight tone of something. Could you go on about that?
That's the whole book. The story is in the book. It clearly sometimes will show exactly where the wall had been hit by me and where I thought I'd hit the wall because of the skin color,
mm-hmm.
which I think for me it was true. And that in particular, on the appointment side, there was... has always been the tagline on me is that I took care of cronies. And invariably, the assumption was that if you take care of cronies, you're obviously taking care of people who are not qualified, period. And it was really horrendous in terms of accusations when the person appointed happened to be a person of color. And particularly blacks.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago when Dianne Feinstein, now a U.S. senator, was running for mayor. She ran for mayor a couple of times and lost. Mm-hmm. I mean, lost badly. You know, like running third or fourth or something when there were only two people in the race. She really lost badly. She really lost badly. Joe Alioto, who was probably one of San Francisco's most outspoken and Renaissance-type mayors, was in a debate with her when they were seeking election, and he had had the job for a while, and he had been really good at it, and he had always appointed his friends and his relatives to every position there was without criticism. And Dianne decided to make it an issue, and because some of them were of questionable quality. And she said, he appointed X and he appointed Y and he appointed Z. It's relatives and friends. And when I'm mayor, I will not appoint relatives and friends of mine to positions of influence. Alioto gets up and the place goes crazy. Alioto gets up and he said, Madam Feinstein, when I'm reelected mayor, I won't appoint your friends or relatives either. And he got away with it. If I had said that, they would run me out of town. But in the world of politics, you really use your appointment power appropriately to put people who are on the same playing page with you for public policy purposes. And if they are relatives and friends, you're really well off. Jack Kennedy, in my review of his life, things he said about himself when asked, why did you make your brother Bobby Kennedy the Attorney General? His response was, only because my mother was not a lawyer. She was my first choice. And I believe in that. I believe in that system. And so my appointments did reflect that belief and that loyalty. When I went away from that standard, invariably, I appointed an ingrate. People who didn't remember where they got the appointment, didn't remember who the boss was, and there are a whole series of them, people still hold an office like that. I appointed people to the Board of Supervisors, and within 2 or 3 months, they voted to override my veto. Well, you'd think at least you ought to leave me with dignity of no override, but these people you appoint are just so ambitious, unless you have some way to pull the plug on them, if they cross you, you don't really want to make the appointment. So what do? Yes, relatives and friends who may not be able to read or write, but but they don't cross you.
What about that guy who was the member of the City Arts Commission you had appointed, and I guess he was a pretty smart fellow, and something came up, and he calls you up and he says, Mr. Mayor, I won't be able to go along with you on this. And you said...
What did I say I said?
You said, you said I appointed you.
Yeah. Let me tell you a story. Stanley Gatti, who most recently in the Los Angeles area did the SAG Awards, he's done the Academy Awards. He's an incredible design guy, incredible party guy, and he was... Really, he literally adopted me. He has about 25 or 30 of the top socialites in San Francisco, including Danielle Steele, that he does all of their events and all of their activities, whether it's weddings, whether it's showers, whether it's funerals, whether it's wakes. He does all of the things for them, and he will not work with a budget. If you want somebody who's going to work with a budget, you better get somebody else. Stanley, I recall... One time a client of mine said, so you recommended Stanley Gatti to me for my daughter's wedding. And he has told me $440,000, submitted a bill to me for $440,000. I said, that's cheap. He says, no, that's just for the flowers. So Stanley is incredible. I convinced Stanley to become the chair of the Arts Commission, because that's his area. He's a good friend, and he had been, you know, like a running buddy all the time that I was campaigning for the job as mayor, and I frankly didn't know anybody else that I could put on the Arts Commission, and Stanley agreed to accept it. But Stanley had never been involved in politics. He got in a dispute with a woman named Sue Bierman, who had been with me since 1962. She had been a precinct walker. She had pushed my kids in the stroller. She'd babysat. She had turned her house upside down on a staging process to raise money for me. So she really had an equitable relationship. She hated Bufano. Hated Bufano. I'm sorry, reverse. She loved Bufano. Stanley hated Bufano. And we had this huge donation that had been accepted by the city from Benny Bufano. and it was in front of our airport. And Sue Bierman wanted to stay in front of our airport. Stanley, when we were remodeling the airport, wanted to remove the Pufanon. And he explained to me what the deal was and the theme and how Benny was not much of a sculpturer, etc. It was not like Frank Gehry or any of those people that Stanley just loved that I didn't understand. So I started arguing with him. And I always argue with my appointees first. And if that doesn't work, then I order them. But he was arguing with me, and it got down to the point where I just had to order him to do it by telling him. But Stanley got me in trouble always. He got in trouble because he tried to put a foot on the waterfront, a huge foot. I mean, just an unbelievable, like a giant foot. Because Stanley's got weird taste when it comes to things. And while I defend him full time, there were some things I couldn't go along with. He finally quit the Arts Commission. And we're the best of friends. Talk to him 3 or 4 times a week. And well, whenever I need to send flowers, he sends them, and I've never seen a bill. I don't know whose bill the flowers go on. They go on somebody's bill. But.
Well, let's get back to politics. I know that everybody's here is interested in the presidential campaign. So we were talking about African-Americans in politics. What about Obama? Talk about him. What are his chances of winning? What do you think of him? What about his chances for success for the nomination? His chances against McCain in November? That whole thing.
Well, I met Barack Obama by telephone sometimes in late 2003, early 2004. There's a network around the country of probably 12 or 15 African-American people who are really into trying to help produce resources for real potential qualified African-Americans to hold office, whether it's Devon Patrick running for the governorship of the state of Massachusetts, whether it was Doug Wilder running for in Virginia, you name it, and we get called upon for resources. And being the guy in California, along with Maxine Waters from down here, I'm always called upon. We were the largest single contributors to Carol Moseley Braun's race in Illinois for the U.S. Senate. We were the same with reference to Carl McCall for the controller. So the network says produce dough. And they call me up and said, we got this guy Barack Obama who's going to run for the U.S. Senate in the state of Illinois. It's clear that a black can win there. Carol has done it. You helped Carol. Can you put together something for him? I said, let me tell you something. Nobody named Barack Obama is going to win anything. That's a waste. And I want to exercise my right not to do something foolish. I have my friends do something foolish. They said, no. You got to just take the call. I finally agreed to take the call. The guy who leaned on me was Eugene Duffy out of Atlanta, Georgia, who's now kind of an advisor to Shirley Franklin. Sure enough, this guy calls me. And the first thing he says is, Gene told me you didn't think a guy named Barack Obama can win anything. I said, absolutely, I'm of that opinion. He said, let me explain to you why, you know, the name, et cetera. Everybody will remember the name. I said, no, everybody remembers Willie Brown. They don't remember Barack Obama. Nobody can even pronounce your name. If you don't watch out, it'll be Borat before it's Barack. And we went back and forth. We had a good time. He was charming. And I decided, yes, we will help him. So we put on an event for him at the Waterfront Restaurant in San Francisco and raised a lot of money for the Senate race. Nobody had a clue who came and donated. They were just doing it because they were asked to do it by the outgoing mayor. And so it was a good event, fun event. But his presence there literally said to me, this guy's agenda is much bigger than the U.S. Senate. I didn't think presidency, but it was clearly much bigger than U.S. Senate. He was extremely bright. He was charming. All the ladies loved him. As a matter of fact, our district attorney, Kamala Harris, I introduced the two of them and gave her the responsibility to actually present him to the public there. Newsom was there. Everybody was there, and they met Obama. And the Lord smiled on Obama. His three opponents in the primary all tanked. for one reason or another. They all had more money, and but they got busted and got corruption probe, and they imploded with problems with women and drugs and all the things that happened. It's almost like somebody, you know, you'd think that he went to Louisiana and the root lady did something to him. So he wins the primary. I mean, handsomely wins the primary. 30 points or something with nothing going for him. Nothing going for him. We thought, well, if Carroll won, maybe we can get this guy over the hump in the general. Lo and behold, a guy named Jack Ryan was his opponent. And the Republicans had envisioned Jack Ryan to be the guy that would eventually be their candidate for president from the state of Illinois. He was like Mitt Romney with real life in him. He was really, he was very impressive. Tall and angular and country club set, handicapped golfer, and I mean all those things that you would think, and with a lot of money. So the Republicans were really happy, except the guy had been really abusive, and he had been exploiting his wife for a long period of time. She finally rose up and rebelled and wanted custody of the one child they had. And he didn't want her to have custody. He didn't think she was a fit mother. And he set about trying to prove that she wasn't a fit mother. Well, that really incensed her. He, however, had the records of those proceedings sealed, because obviously something was in those records that would be devastating to his candidacy, since the evangelical right had him as their poster boy. Well, lo and behold, this woman convinced the court here in Santa Monica, as a matter of fact, to unseal the records. And they unsealed the records, and this guy was a combination of every bad thing that you could think of. All that great presence went right out the window when you found out that he had been having his wife do lap dances for pursuit of contracts for his business and things like that. And so everybody walked away from him. He was toxic. Like you wouldn't believe. It took him 2 or 3 weeks to figure it out, but he was toxic, and he wasn't going anywhere. Obama, about to be the beneficiary of another failure on the part of an opponent. So the root lady was still working. And then Mike Ditka became the guy who was next going to be the Republican nominee when they were going to replace him. And lo and behold, Mike Ditka's wife informed him that he absolutely had no heart that functioned, and that she would abandon him because he was going to kill himself with his bad heart. Well, he decided, well, I can't do it. So he couldn't do it. At that stage of the game, the Republicans were up the creek. They had nobody. They called a black guy in Maryland named Alan Keyes, who had been a candidate for president on the Republican side, and ask him if he would run. And Alan Keyes is a very sharp guy, very smooth guy, and he absolutely knows that he's going to be fully financed in the state of Illinois for this open Senate seat. And sure enough, he said, yes, he's going to run. But he says, I won't move from Maryland because the Constitution doesn't require me to move from Maryland. If I win, all I have to do is get there before I'm sworn in. And so that's what I'll do. And, of course, I advised Barack Obama to welcome Alan Keyes in the race and say that there should be 2 debates, one in his home and one in Alan's home. And that would be the nature of the debates. Well, obviously, Barack Obama won. He became the darling of everybody on the Democratic side. He was the guy who did the keynote speech at the convention, and it was as good as Arnold's keynote speech. And the same year, he was just incredibly impressive in that presentation. He won the U.S. Senate seat, and at that moment, I had no idea that he was thinking presidency even then. But obviously, he was, and he clearly has hit upon a theme that was different. When he told me he's going to run for president, I again told him, "You got to be joking. Hillary is going to wax your wig, my man. She's going to clean your clock. There's no way." But he's got the root lady working again. Poor Hillary is stumbling around in the jungle, can't find the trail that's been left for her, and Barack Obama is soaring above the whole terrain, getting made $35 or $36 million in the last 30 days, 10 wins in a row, and he clearly is now winning in Wisconsin and Hawaii like he was in South Carolina. Apparently he must be transporting some black people to those locations because he's winning handsomely, except that he's only 100 or so delegate votes ahead of Hillary. Everybody has counted this thing as over because of his 10-0 wins. Well, you know, the 10-0 doesn't mean anything to insiders. It's the delegate count, and they are about 100 or so parties the delegate count, and there are not enough left out there to be one to give either one of them the numbers among the people. The super delegates are possessed of the deciding vote, and he is now, Obama is now employing the strategy that the super delegates ought to reflect what occurred in the districts from whence they come. Now you understand, when we set up the super delegates, we set up the superdelegates in direct contrast to the conduct in the districts. We set up the superdelegates because we had this crazy system where if you were Jerry Brown, you had to run in a district in order to get to be a delegate to the convention, and it might be a district where that week people were hostile to something you've done. And here you are, an icon in the party, and you're not even a delegate. I remember when 72, John Taney was the U.S. Senator, and I got a call from Frank Mankiewicz, the head of the McGovern campaign, saying, you got to put Taney on the delegate. You can't leave your U.S. Senator out. He can't be just a visitor. Well, the Democratic Party solved that by making every U.S. Senator in the Democratic side a superdelegate, every congressman a superdelegate, every significant state chair, a superdelegate. Every one of us who are a member of the National Committee, a superdelegate. We are the keepers of the trust. We are the Da Vinci Code participants. And we will vote like we are part of the Da Vinci Code.
So you're a superdelegate?
Not anymore. I resigned because I decided to come over to your world.
And to go into the writing business?
No, not the writing business. Commentary.
The analyst business, right?
The journalist business. Yeah, and I'm glad I did. Because can you imagine me trying to make a decision between a brother and a white woman? That's tough duty.
It's hard. Yeah, being a journalist, you're not responsible for anything. Well, how is this going to go? So you see it going into the convention with neither of them with the majority.
Well, at this stage of the game. Just pure numbers.
Yeah.
Neither of them will have 2025. Mm-hmm. Based on what's out there, you'd have to have people start to do some switches and some changes. There's some people doing that already. I think Hillary's probably lost from among her pledged superdelegates. By the way, you don't have to wait for the convention if you're a superdelegate. You can announce that you're supporting one or the other now, and some have done that.
But there's no threat of perjury. I mean, you can change your mind.
Oh, yeah, you're not pledged to anything.
You're entitled until
you vote.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. The one thing we didn't do, we were really smart with the idea of the superdelegates. It's appropriate to maintain the integrity of your organization. But what we should have done is that we should have said, you must cast your vote by the first primary. You listen to all of what's going on and what have you. Because after all, some of the superdelegates would have wanted to vote for Bill Richardson. Some of the superdelegates would have wanted to vote for John Edwards. Can you imagine if you were casting a vote and you did it on absentee ballot, and then John Edwards quit, your vote meant nothing in California. Well, if you were a superdelegate, people would not now be debating because the superdelegate votes would already have been cast, and we'd wait to count them after all the primaries are over, and that would eliminate all of this nonsense that's currently going on around superdelegates. Well, we were not smart enough to see that.
I'd like to get back to your book and your career. Could you single out your proudest accomplishment as speaker and your proudest accomplishment as mayor?
No way I could do either one.
Yeah.
No, this is a career of 40 plus years. You'd have to go almost session by session. You know, what am I most proud of? The passage of the decriminalization of sexual acts between consenting adults. That's a momentous.
Yep.
It was a momentous shift in the political winds of California. It was the, frankly, somewhere near the anchor tenet that prompts gays and lesbians to now be able to have the freedom to participate without, as lawyers or teachers or other persons licensed in the state, losing their license because their conduct on the privacy side would have been considered not consistent with the moral standards for the job that they held or the license that they held. That's a tremendous achievement, but that's not the most significant achievement. Helping to orchestrate and setting up the apparatus so that the Maxine Waters efforts to get Mandela out of jail, and California was key in that, with George Duke Majan coming in with us through the University of California Board of Regents, and then the legislature, and then the Congress, and going from there, prompted Nelson to come into California, three stops, only place in the country when he was here that he did three stops, and it was thank us. Yeah, that's a proud moment. Mike Roos's business of orchestrating how we got on the weapon bans, and that's an interesting story into itself. Yeah. That whole business is in the book.
Yeah.
And how we did that. That's a very proud moment. The Urban Impact Aid formula that picked up where Jess Unruh had left off in trying to get money on an equal basis as it relates to need for school districts, and particularly disadvantaged school districts. The child health screening and prevention bill that was put in. Well, the business of regulating insurance companies for the cancellation of auto insurance policies that Jerry Walde helped me produce. There's so many things on the legislative side. And then on the city side, I mean, just building the stadium and the stem cell research operations that the University of California has and the biotech campus, the restoration of the waterfront and restoration of City Hall and the renovation of Union Square and the building of all those schools, in particular the Bessie Carmichael School that we did. There's so many things that I couldn't tell you that there's anyone that is greater than another, except I would suspect that having been the foundation in some points for careers of people who still hold public office, I'd have to be extraordinarily proud of that. And my disappointments?
Well,
term limits passed and I couldn't remain Speaker for life.
You would have been Speaker for life. One of the stories I liked in the book is you talked about South Africa, and this was a story of, really, as you mentioned, but this was an unlikely combination of you and Maxine Waters and George Duke Majan and tuna fish sandwiches in the Capitol cafeteria, and you put all those ingredients together for this incredible law. Could you talk about that a little bit?
In the business of politics and building consensus and get into public policy, you don't always do so by the great speeches. You don't always do so even by the content of your proposed legislation. Many times you have to work the process of building relationships with people so they trust you and they'll give you a vote on things that they may have only a minor interest in, and then sometimes they may even disagree with the whole policy. Well, George Duke Majan, fabulous man who served both as an assembly member with me, a state senator, then the attorney general of the state of California, ran and won the governorship. An unlikely winner at every level because he was virtually friendless. There was nobody who really spent any time with him. He didn't drink or smoke. I'm not even sure that he had ever been to a movie. He really was like Cube in every way. Nobody bothered with hanging with George Duke Majan. Well, I'm in the world of politics, I'm always looking for people who are in need of friends and relatives, because who knows when they may hold the key to your survival. And the book shows that that played off really well for me. It was a heavy-duty investment. In this case, I happened to wander downstairs, and you know the Capitol as well as I do, and you know that there's a cafeteria downstairs. There's a relatively expensive joint upstairs, but there's a people's cafeteria downstairs. Duke Major never went to the top floor on the sixth floor. He always went to the basement, and he always sat at a little table by himself, and he ate he would always have tuna fish. Well, I saw him a couple of times in there. I said, he's by himself. Perfect. I went over and joined him. I had some familiarity with tuna fish sandwiches. That's in the book, too.
Yes, it is.
And I was a tuna lover. And by the way, on this tour, that's all Simon & Schuster allows you time to do.
Is have a tuna fish sandwich.
Correct. And they want the media escorts, the people who take you around, like Diana Foss, who's with me today. They all want to stop. Oh, we get you a sandwich. Get me a sandwich, my ass. I'm hungry. I don't want a sandwich. Back to Duke Majan. I joined Duke for a sandwich in the basement on more than one occasion, and that became a regular kind of thing with us. And it became a joyful thing because I discovered that he really was a delightful guy. And I recall on one of our sessions talking him into signing the bill that created the World Trade Commission. He had never been abroad. He had never, didn't have a passport. This is a guy who really lived in Long Beach. I mean, you know, he really did live there. I met his wife, Gloria. We became friends, and we started to talk about things that were affecting the world. And one of the things, obviously, was Nelson Mandela being in jail and what role the U.S. was playing in propping up, through the trade relationships and the investment, South Africa. And one thing about Duke Majan, he really is substantively subject matter oriented without reference to his political party. As a matter of fact, as I said, I don't think he had anything to do with the Republican Party. And as a result of that, he agreed to, first, as we served as fellow regents, let's move it and divest the heavyweight endowment fund of our university that should have been leading it anyway. The university ought to stand for things that politicians cannot do. They ought to stand for real human rights. They ought to be almost as far out there on the deal of human rights as Joan Baez and that operation that she does, Amnesty International. Well, lo and behold, Duke Majan agreed, and we moved the bill after numerous tries through the legislature, got it signed, and you know, there's some things that we did in order to get it there. But we had already done it at the university because he used his appointment power at the Board of Regents to get folk to support his motion at the Board of Regents for divestment. And that coupled with people that had been put on there by Jerry Brown, and the results were we divested from the university and promptly divested with the state of California, and that was promptly translated into congressional action that promptly led to other jurisdictions throughout the country doing the same thing. And lo and behold, the South African government was brought to its knees, and Nelson Mandela was released, and all of that marvelous.
And he came to the Capitol.
He came to the Capitol to say thank you. And believe me, it's interesting that it was a Republican governor named George Duke Majan who signed it. And you would have thought, if he signed it, he's obviously going to run for president. George Duke Majan never wanted to run for anything else. Unlike Obama, he had no ambition.
Can we move on? Let's talk about your marriage. The only reason I bring it up is because you brought it up in the book. You write that you've been married to your wife Blanche for more than 50 years, although you only lived together for 25 of them. And you point out that I've led quite an active and varied social life over the years. Is that your prescription for a happy marriage? I just want to know. I'm a husband. I mean, I want to know.
I don't have a prescription for a happy marriage. I assume that there is a happy marriage somewhere. But I don't have a prescription for happy marriage. That section of the book, Bill, I don't think I could have produced a memoir without being heavily criticized if I did at least address that issue, because, you know, terrible reputation on that side of the ledger, but not with Blanche. She's, you know, still is an admirer and a friend, mm-hmm. a good friend. And I detest politicians who engage in whatever they engage in that has nothing to do with their performance in public office, doing their official duties and what they do privately, and then when it's called to their attention, they proceed to confess and ask for forgiveness and go to rehab and do all those crazy things, and then they clearly repeat that conduct because they are serial hypocrites, not just one-time hypocrites. Well, I didn't want to be in that category, and I don't think it's healthy to be in that category. I don't think the public requires it of you. I think you insult the public by, trying to cover it up as best you can. And so it's best to just say, hey, this is me, I'm doing it, and it ain't your business.
Very good. I bet the...
That's my formula for a happy marriage.
That's your
formula. Except that I'd say you might want to do that long distance, because if you were close, the sister might do something to you.
Yeah. I might not do that. I bet there's questions from the audience.
And we have a microphone right here, so raise your hand, and
you'll be able to call on. Okay, right over there. You, hand up. Right there.
Good afternoon, Mr. Brown. one question I want to ask. I was the deputy director in 2000 for the Democratic Convention. And one of the problems that I had, even though I had credentials to go all over, I want to know what you think about racial profiling, because I was stopped maybe 20 to 30 times when I'm going all over, and I was the highest African-American in the Democratic Party. Do you still find these type of things still going on?
Oh, sure. Racism in America has not altered itself substantially. Although I've got to tell you, though, that Mr. Obama has done what some African Americans have managed to do at the state level and at the local level, and that is cause themselves to be looked at first as a qualified candidate rather than as a black man trying to qualify. Obama has done what Devon Patrick did in Massachusetts when he won. They looked at him as a qualified candidate who happens to be black. That's never happened at the national level. They looked at Jesse as a black candidate. They look at Obama as a candidate who happens to be black. Racial profiling and conduct associated is still in the country. You experience it, I experience it, anybody who's on... who happens to be of a different ethnicity will experience it. I was at a Tet festival, and that's a festival where Asians in there have New Year problem. I was there on Sunday, and a brother, I identified him instantly as a brother. It turns out that his mother is from Vietnam, and his dad is from Ohio or someplace. And he tells me that in that community in which he lives, and he was raised in Vietnam, he just moved over here maybe 3 or 4 years ago. He lives in Orange County, where there is a big community from that part of the world. And he tells me that a person with darker skin than the normal person from Vietnam is discriminated against by the people who are here from Vietnam, as much as we're discriminated against. He wanted to know if there's any place he could go. He understood that if he was being discriminated by white people as a black, but he had no place to go if he's just being discriminated by the other half of his ethnicity. So America is really still plagued with racism and with discrimination. Not as bad as it was when I lived in that little town called Mineola, Texas. That was a real segregated place. The tracks were the dividing line, and there were no paved roads and no paved streets and no city services delivered, absolutely nothing. The school was a separate and dramatically unequal facility. That was real segregation. Discrimination followed on segregation when Brown versus the Board of Education came along in 1954, and slowly this nation began to literally say, we're not going to segregate, but we may still discriminate. And it's very American to discriminate, and it's equally as American to deny that you're discriminating. And so you experience that on the floor of the convention. You go this year, and I guarantee you the security guys will treat you the same way.
Yes, sir, over here. Front row.
So I have two questions. Mayor Brown, do you think that the renovation and beautification of the 3rd Street, Hunters Point, Bayview District in San Francisco pose a threat to low-income families prevalent in that area? Examples of that would be the T-Line, the multi-million dollar lofts. It's an example of gentrification. And how, as a community, can low-income families protect their assets from the highest bidder? I used to live in Bernal Heights, which is in the Mission District, and the past 10 to 15 years, the Mission District has been gentrified. Low-income families have been moved out. And what do you think that the community in the Bayview can do to kind of either slow down or reverse that process?
Well, first and foremost, your question is relevant for almost every urban area in America. You specialized it by identifying yourself as having lived in San Francisco, knowing certain neighborhoods, which probably nobody else in here would recognize. The Hunters Point, 3rd Street, Bayview area was a primarily an American community. They had the highest incidence of home ownership. It's also the place where, if you did an assessment of toxic problems in that city, they would be specialized in that area. The sewer treatment facility is located out there. The Hunters Point Naval Shipyard is located out there. Almost every form of manufacturing is located out there. Much of the low-income housing built for war workers in the Second World War is located out there. It's a community in which there has not been any new capital investments from the private sector for years and years and years, and not much from the public sector. I became mayor of San Francisco. I wanted to open up all parts of the city and make it so that people could go from one side of the city to the other, feeling comfortable and safe, and have the same kind of services. Not even Walmart wanted to locate anything out there. It's the only place where there's no Starbucks. It's the only place where there's no Rite Aid. It's the only place where, you know, none of the things you traditionally see. I don't even think Walmart wanted to put anything out there. And so it was a community totally isolated. The 3rd Street Light Rail has now opened up access to that whole area, to the whole city. And when we do the 3rd Street Light Rail on through the center of Union Square with the Central Subway into Chinatown in North Beach, you'll have linked San Francisco and those isolated communities. You will have aligned them. We're closing the power plants that are located in that particular area and requiring the land to be cleaned up so it can be utilized for other purposes. Now, suddenly, entrepreneurs or seeing the potential for this particular neighborhood in this particular community. My guess is other places in America, similar kinds of things are happening to communities with similar descriptions. And it's always a challenge. Do you leave that neighborhood the way it is because low-cost housing happens to be there? Or do you step in and get rid of the toxics and do all those things and pay for it
by the increased value that comes with the availability of cleaned up sites. Most governments proceed to do it and have it self-funded in that manner. And the argument always is, well, the people who live there won't be able to afford it. That's right. They won't probably be able to afford it. Many of them who live there, however, owned their piece of turf. And if somebody comes by and offers them five, six, or seven times the appraised value of their property, they usually take it and move some other place, move to better quarters, move further out of the city, acquire places with garages and yards and potential for better schools. And it's hard to make the judgment that you ought to maintain this place in its terrible condition because you want to protect low-cost housing. I think it's a bad choice that you'd make if you did that. I think it's more important that you do what I did. In the introductory remarks, the reference was made to an affordable housing bond that I convinced in 96 the citizens to approve and pass. And that affordable housing bond married community reinvestment money, married money I got from Henry Cisneros and then ultimately from Andrew Cuomo out of HUD, married money I got from the AFL-CIO Real Estate Investment Trust Fund, and we produced some 15,000 to 17,000 units, new units of affordable housing in San Francisco in my term. I think it's better to do that than to maintain the slums, so to speak. There are no slums in San Francisco, and there are no slums in San Francisco because we've made sure there were never any slums in San Francisco. There is a better affordable housing program in San Francisco in partnership with people I reference in the book. I talked about the Sacred Cartel in the book. The Sacred Cartel is a collection of community activists, mostly white, almost 100% white, except for the Chinese component of it. They don't seem to worry about what happens to black people among these progressives. But they were my partners in producing all of this housing. I think that's a better way to go than to simply say, absolutely not. I'm not going to put a Third Street light rail in. I'm not going to put new methods of transportation. I'm not going to improve with reference to many parks produced by the increased value of the resources. I think it's better to produce a higher quality of life for everybody and then hopefully fund programs and policies that allows for workforce housing, that allows for low-income housing, that allows for the revitalization of public housing through the Hope 6 programs. And I got more Hope 6 programs than any other mayor in the country. Got so many Hope 6 programs out of HUD that we got blacklisted, not eligible for like 5 years from any more Hope 6. We were so much smarter than all the other cities throughout the country. We knocked out all the institutional public housing and turned it into something that was fairly decent. And so it's a long answer, but don't buy into the argument you ought to maintain the slums as they presently exist.
Yes, sir, with the red tie right there. Oh.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, I think everyone appreciates tonight the candor which you've been talking about political sausage making and everything that goes into it, and it's very refreshing. There's a lot of talk going on the past few years, probably a lot longer than that, about reforming political systems in the state of California. Are there any reforms that, in your opinion, make sense or that would be worthwhile? Or is it simply a matter of rearranging the deck chairs again or people developing a new political reform, which really is more, you know, to advantage their position or their party?
Well, I really haven't given any time or effort or thought to the whole business of reforming the political system. I just haven't. I know that there are lots of people who spend all that time doing that, but that's never been one of my areas of interest. I tinker occasionally. For an example, I really thought it important that we move away from only rich white people vote an absentee ballot, that everybody ought to be encouraged to vote absentee ballot. And I'm glad we have succeeded in doing that, because all of a sudden my housing authority residents are voting at the same percentage level in the political system, as since they no longer have to prove that they're either hospitalized, dying, or on vacation to vote absentee ballot. We changed those rules. I would love to get same-day registration, because I think there are lots of people who can't vote because they didn't comply with the stupid rule of 30 days before you go to vote. Well, I would think that we ought to be able to devise a system to achieve that. I also think that the business about voting machines, I'm amused, frankly. I've been trying to figure out how to trick that ATM all my life, and I've not been successful. So why the hell can I be equally as unsuccessful at tricking the voting machine? But for whatever reason, we can't get there. I believe that the convenience of voting, starting like on Saturday and running through Tuesday for everybody to be able to cast a vote, those are the kind of things I've toyed around with. But trying to reform the system to make sure that there's a third-party opportunity, that's all nonsense, in my opinion. That's a waste of time. People, if you want to do third-party, you do third-party. If you want to do Democrats, you do Democrats. You want to be an independent, you're an independent. And it's based on whatever, you know, impresses you at the moment. There are very few of us who are so much into politics that day in and day out we're worrying about trying to create an opportunity for an alternative to us.
You had a question right over here. You, yes, no, you in the front row.
Thanks. Mr. Brown, even though you're not so interested in reforming the system, I was wondering about something very basic, such as redistricting. And I was wondering what you thought about taking redistricting of our state Senate and state assembly districts away from the state legislature and having some sort of independent commission handle redistricting.
There's no such thing as an independent commission, period. Be clear. People talk about this business of redistricting. It's okay for me as a legislator to vote on whether or not you should be put to death for some crime. It's okay for me to vote on whether or not you should be licensed to practice medicine or law or accountancy. It's okay for me to determine whether or not certain kinds of substances shall be banned or not banned. It's okay for me to have life or death over your entire financial being by virtue of the tax system. But for whatever reason, you think that I'm incompetent by virtue of conflict of interest to draw lines. Well, you're wrong. I am the representative of the neighborhood that elected me. And that neighborhood says, we really like who we are, we like the way we are, and when you are up there, you keep this neighborhood together, because we would like to see you stay there, because you are the speaker. You are the chair of the Ways and Means Committee. You are the chair of the Health Committee. And if some so-called independent cats who do not have our best interests at heart, and they will not have your best interests at heart, start drawing lines, they may cut us into 10 different little cities with no authority, no power, no nothing. And they may be doing so out of their interests, which may also be a conflict. Because believe me, I don't think the Lord made anybody who is disinterested enough to draw lines and not care what happens at the end of that line drawing. We all have an interest in what happens at the end of the line drawing, and the best way to do that is to hold the cats you elected to do all these other terrible things. You know, like, no man's life, liberty, or property is safe while the legislature is in session. That's a reality. And so there's no reason to assume that your representative can't represent your interests at every level, including line drawing, period. So I am adamantly against the so-called independent commission. There's no way to set up a foolproof method to remove so-called interests, because it shouldn't be removed. There is no earthly reason why my district lines ought to be drawn in such a way that I can't seek re-election.
Yes.
To prove that they are
objective.
You had a question back there? Did you? No. Lady, did you? Oh, you didn't.
No, well, I said we have time for two more questions.
Oh, I thought you were. Oh, I didn't see you back there, Louise. We have time for maybe two more
somebody
questions.
Somebody way up there just...
Okay, way up there. Way up there in the balcony.
I'm going to shake their hand off.
Last row. Or, yeah, that row, right.
Was there any difference in the price of the seats?
It was in the back. Now it's a joke. I'm glad to be talking with you. I was a student at Berkeley. You know, when you were up in San Francisco, and I noticed, well, after I was 19 in D.C., I was interning, and then I went off to Berkeley. And I was really interested in politics and becoming a senator, but then I decided not to, because they were funding B-2 bombers. I was like 19, and a Congress member, he walked me through the House, and he was like, look, you know, they're all voting, you know, to fund the B-2 bombers. Anyway, so I changed my mind, and now I'm an artist, actor, you know, literature.
What was your question?
Well, he goes...
That was a good precision.
Are you now running?
Yeah.
That's what
running.
It sounds like.
Not yet. But my question is, when I went up to Berkeley, I noticed it was very bright. Politics was very bright. Your fashion, I enjoyed it. It got me back interested in the style, the fashion, because I'm a child of hip-hop and fashion and music, and we're into very, you know...
What's your question?
Okay, in regards to three strikes your law and the building of prison systems in California and how California has the most prisons as a state than in comparison to any other nation on the planet, that's a fact by a sociologist. What do you think it's going to be the best policy to deal with all the individuals, all the males that will come out of prison that can't vote, can't find a job, and are largely black and Latino, and how that's going to alter the new generation of our families in Los Angeles, in urban areas, and how is that going to affect basically how we interact as humans here in the nation?
All right. That's a good question. A very good question. And I hope that at some point, as this presidential debate unfolds, some substantive dialogue will take place about the criminal justice delivery system in this nation and the dramatic imbalances existing in that system in the incredible absence of any effective programs designed to reduce recidivism that becomes kind of the cornerstone of why the prison population continues to grow at alarming numbers. In California, we're now at 174,000 plus prisoners. The numbers of those prisoners who happen to be black to the total population and happen to be male to the whole population is just staggering. Just staggering. Black women have less of a chance of finding a husband that who happens to be black simply because out of 10 males, 7 of them have some relationship to the criminal justice system in some fashion or another, and one or two of them may have, you know, sexual orientations different that will not permit them to be an eligible person. That's a whole problem that we need to address in this nation. The exit out of prisons of many of these former inmates who carry with them the HIV positive that they don't even know they're carrying because there's no mandatory test requirements in or out. There's so many issues that exist out there. Our people who are seeking office ought to be talking about it. No, I don't have any formula for addressing the issue. I know that the governor, Schwarzenegger, is currently torn with trying to find some way to remove from the system all these people who are there who did not commit any kind of a violent crime, who are there as check writers, who are there as, nonviolent auto thieves, not carjackers, who are there because of all these things connected to the three strikes law that had nothing to do with violence. And we're spending more per prisoner per year than we spend on education at the higher level in this state. Those are real major substantive issues that need to be addressed. They first, however, need to be discussed.
before you can get to the point of somebody trying to frame a solution. They have so little equitable benefit politically that we politicians don't wander into a subject matter area that doesn't have some political payoff. So you aren't going to have any of us as politicians spend a lot of time discussing the prison system unless we're trying to convince you that we're going to expand it and thereby make your community safe. Our issue is not prison. Our issue is your vote in return for safety. And that's a major, major flaw in the delivery system of criminal justice in this nation. And it reflects a level of results that seem to reflect racism in a greater way than any other part of our economy, any other part of our society, any other part of our human experiences.
We have time for one more question. That's right. Yes, sir. Right over here. Your hands up, right in the center.
This has all been really heavy, so let's get away from it. I'd like to throw out a couple of names to you. Miss Lulu Carter.
Lulu Carter was a icon educator in San Francisco. She lived in the 1200 block of Fell Street, 1300 block of Fell Street. She was a great NAACP person. She was an even greater Negro Cultural and Historical Society person. A very beautiful woman.
I lived at 1030 Fell. Noel Myricks.
Who?
Noel Myricks.
Don't remember that name.
You don't remember now? No. Noel? Mm-mm. Darlene Carter.
Hmm?
Darlene Carter.
Oh, Darlene Carter.
Dolly Dimpers.
She cooked for me more often than my wife.
She lived in my building.
Wonderful woman. It was a nice building you had.
Yeah, she lived in my building. And by the way, Warren says hello. I just spoke to him
Herman?
Before I come down here. Yeah.
Half note.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
In Sacramento.
Well, thank you very much. Mayor?
Bring back memories.
I bet. That was great. That was
thank
great.
You.
Mayor, thank you. Oh, my God.
Really? I know who this is. I know who this is. It's the gay mayor.
You got a question.
I've got a really serious question.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.